folded the entire area.
"Gather on me!"
Grimm shouted, his voice hoarse in the thick dust.
"Gather here! Here!"
He kept calling out, and his crew appeared out of the dust, squinting against it and shielding their mouths. They were covered in a thin layer of dust and dirt that gave them a phantom-like appearance in the grey flatness of the dust cloud. Grimm took a quick head count and began to give the order to move out, when he paused to see one last phantom appear out of the haze. For a moment he wasn't sure what he was looking at. Then the phantom stepped closer and he could see. Bridget Targwyn trudged out of the haze, covered so thickly in dust that she might have been an animated statue. She moved slowly, her face locked in a rictus of determination. Sir Benedict's limp form was draped over one of her shoulders, his arms swinging loosely where they hung down her back. She held one arm wrapped around the back of his thighs, keeping his weight balanced. In that hand she clutched a dust-covered volume. In the other hand she carried the limp form of a dust-covered cat, presumably Master Rowl. One of her booted feet left partially blooded prints in the thin layer of dust on the ground, but she had not let the injury stop her. She simply walked, putting one foot steadily in front of the other in small, deliberate, balanced steps. Grimm felt his eyebrows climbing higher, and for a moment he was at a loss for words. A sudden silence spread through the men of the Predator as they took in the sight themselves. Bridget's steady footsteps were suddenly loud in the firelit dust.
"Kettle,"
Grimm said quietly, and the two of them stepped over to Bridget. The girl blinked when Grimm stopped in front of her. She paused, her balance swaying. It took her a moment to focus on Grimm's face, and then she nodded to herself.
"Captain Grimm,"
she said,
"I've two for the doctor here."
The hand holding the book twitched a few times.
"And this is for the Spyrarch."
With that, she swayed on her feet and one of her knees buckled. Kettle caught Sir Benedict's weight across his stout shoulders, and Grimm braced Bridget and kept her from falling or dropping Rowl, who lifted his head slightly and swept a bleary, unfocused gaze around the area, before his head dropped exhaustedly again. Grimm saw a line on the cat's skull where dust and blood had caked into a scab as thick as Grimm's smallest finger. Grimm caught up Master Rowl before Bridget could drop him, cradled the limp cat in one arm, and took the modest-sized volume from her stiff-fingered hand. To one side, Kettle and some of the men were rigging a makeshift litter upon which to carry Sir Benedict.
"Very well, then, Miss Targwyn,"
he said, pocketing the book.
"Can you walk?"
"Oh, of course,"
Bridget said.
"I've been practicing daily for a good while."
Grimm gave her a dubious glance, but before he could call one of the men over, the little etherealist's apprentice, Folly, appeared out of the haze and calmly slipped herself beneath one of Bridget's arms, supporting the larger girl.
"The Grimm captain is surely observant enough to realize that Bridget has a large bruise swelling on her cheek. She's obviously stunned and in pain. He will also surely note that she has friends."
Grimm regarded Miss Folly for a moment before sweeping both of the young women as low a bow as he could manage. Then he checked on Sir Benedict. He was being bundled into a shipboard coat donated by one of the men. Half a dozen hands would share the burden of carrying the unconscious young man.
"Kettle?" Grimm asked. "Silkweaver venom skip from the swelling on his arm."
Kettle replied, his voice bleak.
"And we've got another half a dozen men down the same way in the tunnels. Maybe, if we get him back to the etherealist, Bacon said he can't do a thing with it."
"Master Ferris is unfortunately out of action,"
Grimm said.
"But we'll do all we can."
"What did he say?"
Folly asked, her voice incredulous.
"The master is... Did something happen?"
"Madame Cavendish visited,"
Grimm reported shortly.
She offered to trade your lives for Master Ferris's collection. He agreed.
Folly's eyes widened.
Oh!
She breathed down at a crystal strung on a bit of string about her neck.
Oh, that is not good at all. That was filling a rather large hole.
Her eyes became distant, unfocused.
Where are the wagons now, I wonder?
Cavendish took them. Grimm replied, Odds seem excellent that she had them thrown off the shipyard platform immediately after.
She blinked her eyes, and suddenly they were alert and focused again.
He is a very good captain, but would seemingly make a very poor gambler,
Folly told her crystal.
The wagons are actually moving down the street toward the shipyard. The puppet lady probably expects to riddle out some kind of pattern that would give her an advantage in future encounters.
Grimm arched an eyebrow.
Young woman, do you mean to tell me that you have the ability to simply locate Master Ferris's collection?
That seems rather obvious,
Folly confided to the crystal.
Certain articles within it, at any rate. It might not be arrogant to say that I am its caretaker for good reason.
Cavendish kept the collection. Grimm mused, thinking. Folly smiled.
It seems that he understands. Clearly the master hoped to buy the Grimm captain enough time to rescue me so that I could recover the collection in turn.
And perhaps he meant more, Miss Folly, Grimm said. We shall make haste back to Predator.
The trek through the streets was frantic, which surprised Grimm. He had expected pure pandemonium. A large section of the Habel in the northeastern quadrant was burning. Smoke was a haze in the air that kept growing thicker, though at least the copious ventilation shafts spread throughout the Habel by the merciful builders were circulating enough air to prevent the place from becoming an immediate death trap. Crews of citizens had turned out to fight the blaze by a variety of means, through hoses being pumped full of water from the Habel's many cisterns, through lines of men passing buckets of water from hand to hand, and through crews frantically knocking down expensive wooden buildings and dragging the materials away to create a firebreak. In fact, Grimm thought, there was a great deal too much organization in the chaos. As an experienced officer, he knew what it meant to hold command in a crisis situation. Mostly it was, to use a particularly apt metaphor, rushing around to put out fires one after another. It often required a great deal of shouting and potentially the measured knocking of a few heads to one degree of literality or another. Grimm knew what chaos looked like, and someone had taken steps to forestall it. Firefighting crews were being directed mostly by men whom someone uncharitable would simply call thugs. Though they wore no uniforms and did not bear common gear, the men all had a certain demeanour about them, one to which their fellow citizens of Landing seemed to react. An actual evacuation was taking place, women and children being walked in calm, careful groups toward the nearest transport spiral, to retreat to a lower level of the spire and away from the blaze. Adult men and women, freed of the need to fear for and protect their children, were able to turn their hands to fighting to save their homes and Habel. The guilds, Grimm realized. The criminal guilds of Landing had organized the response to the emergency. Which made sense, he supposed. If the Habel burned down, it would take their livelihood with it, along with the rest of the Habel's residents. But still, the situation had developed no more than an hour ago. By all rights, the Habels should be in a state of bloody-minded panic. Someone had warned the guilds, told them to be ready to act in the event of trouble. Grimm's little force moved steadily through the streets. They drew attention from the guildsmen moving through the city, picking up a few shadows who followed them as they progressed, but no one tried to stop them. They started finding bodies as the group clattered down the last few streets leading to the shipyard. They lay scattered here and there, mostly citizens of Landing, mostly armed. Here and there lay a uniformed Auroran marine among them, but only a very few. The Aurorans knew their business well, and had been moving swiftly and working together. The scant handful of citizens and guildsmen who had opposed them had been dispatched with ruthless efficiency. At the passage out to the shipyard, a dozen of the Spyrarch's guardsmen lay heaped together. The men had died defending the exit, and had been stacked like cordwood to one side to prevent the corpses from blocking the way out. Grim never slowed, leading the little column out onto the deck of the shipyard, his boots thudding on the heavy wooden beams. Fires blazed away at two nearby storage houses, and in several of the light cannon emplacements that defended the shipyard. At least three of the docked airships were on fire, and several still forms littered the deck. Grim's heart began to pound wildly until he spotted Predator, still seemingly safe and sound in her slip. And then there was a howl of etheric cannon, and one of the unburnt gun emplacements exploded into a cloud of burning splinters and blinding light. Grim's eyes snapped up to where the mist shark hovered in the mist, perhaps 100 yards off the shipyard. Even as he watched, her guns spoke again and again, blowing enormous holes in the wooden deck, raking the helpless, vulnerable hulls of the ships at port, and setting even more of the decking on fire. Howl after howl gave birth to thunderous cacophony. One of the blasts ripped through the wooden hull of a vessel at the far end of the shipyard, and by luck struck its power core. There was a burst of light and heat, so bright that it blinded Grim, so hot that it scorched his face. He was flung from his feet as the decking of the shipyard let out a tortured moan, and tons of shattered wood went flying in every direction, shredding the ships nearest the luckless transport. And then, with a screaming crack of protesting timbers, half of the shipyard decking fell away from the side of the spire, broken. Airships, battened down for port and unready to fly, fell like so many stones, and Grim could hear their crews screaming helplessly as they did. Dock workers and stevedores plunged down into the misty depths, along with the shipyard, lending their own screams to the din, as simple and merciless gravity claimed them all together, timber, spar, and soul. And still, blast after blast howled down from Mist Shark's cannon, shattering more of the shipyard's decking like an angry man with a hammer destroying fine tableware, and claiming airship after airship with methodical precision, unleashing the full destructive power of an armed vessel upon the defenseless shipyard.
"Fall back!" Grim screamed. "Into the spire! Get off the deck!"
The aeronauts scrambled back into the shelter of the spire as the cannon fire walked closer and closer. Grim was the last one to step off of the deck, and so close was the enemy fire as he did that he could feel the force of it through the soles of his boots. Grim had time to turn around before, with a screaming groan, the entire shipyard began to twist and shift before what would be an inevitable fall down the obdurate height of Spire Albion to the surface. Grim saw the level deck begin to tilt and slide, fires burning in dozens of places. Predator swayed helplessly in her slip. And then the cannon fire from Mist Shark reached Predator, and Grim's ship, his home, vanished in a deafening thundercloud of fire and blinding light.
Chapter 61. Spire Albion, Habel Landing Shipyard, AMS Predator. Gwen frantically hooked up leads to the main engineering panel, one after another, working as rapidly as she could. She lay on her back beneath the control panel, working with her arms stretched out, while around her the engineering spaces became a shouting, noisome scene of frenetic activity.
"Curse your miserable guts, get that breaker hooked up!"
Journeyman bellowed.
"You there! I will personally kick you to the surface if you don't bring that resistor online!"
"Main power leads up!"
someone shouted.
"Leads to lift crystal up!"
called someone else.
"Blast you all to the surface!"
Journeyman screamed.
"Get back from the core!" I'm engaging the cage in 10 seconds.
The leads aren't up,
Gwen growled at the engineer beneath her breath.
They'd better be, Journeyman said. 9, 8, 7.
Gwen frantically made her fingers fly even faster.
I can only do it so fast.
Better be fast enough, Journeyman said. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Gwen slipped the last pair of lines into place and slapped the clamp down over them.
1. Power in the core.
Journeyman adjusted the controls and the two halves of the power core's petal-like Haslett cage gracefully slid up and around the core, settling into their spherical configuration. Predator's core crystal came to life with a deep and musical hum, and arcs of greenish energy began to flicker rapidly across the interior of the Haslett cage. Almost at once, the temperature in the room jumped by several degrees.
Is that it? Gwen said. Did we do it?
Power core's up, Journeyman growled. Soon as she's warmed up and ready, we get to find out if there are any flaws in any of these new crystals.
Gwen sniffed and lifted her chin. Every crystal is thoroughly inspected and tested at the Lancaster Vattery. They're fine. Just then, there was a scream of a discharging etheric cannon, almost instantly followed by roaring thunder.
God in heaven, they've begun, Journeyman breathed.
General Quarters, strap up, boys, strap up!
Men began rushing about the cabin, frantically passing out complex bundles of leather straps from storage lockers on the walls. One of them tossed a bundle of straps to Journeyman and a second to Gwen.
What on earth is this?
Gwen asked.
Battle harness, Journeyman said. Strap it on.
Gwen lifted the collection of straps dubiously.
I'm sorry?
Journeyman's hands flew with the expertise of long, long practice, and his own ball of mysterious strapping was somehow transformed into a collection of belts that crisscrossed his torso and wrapped his waist. Each strap was liberally festooned with copper-clad steel rings. Journeyman then shook out a strap with clips on either end. He clipped one of them to a ring at his waist. He clipped a second line opposite, and a third in the center of his body at the waistline. Howling cannon cried out again. This time there was a sound so enormous that Gwen simply could not believe that it happened. It shook the deck beneath her feet, made her stagger, slapped against her like an unseen wind, and then there was a vast, grinding, crunching noise that followed it for almost half a minute.
"What on earth was that?"
Gwen asked, her breath coming short. Journeyman grimaced and looked shaken himself. He began arranging Gwen's harness around her.
"One of those shots must have hit a power core farther down the shipyard. Probably that little Piker ship at the far end."
"How could you know that?"
"We're still here,"
the engineer answered.
If it had taken one of the bigger ships, it would have smeared us all over the side of the spire.
He thumped Gwen on the shoulder to get her to turn around, then grunted, adjusted a belt, and started clipping lines to her waist.
3 lines, he said. Keep them hooked up to a securing ring at all times. You don't want to be standing there flat-footed when we drop a few 100 feet abruptly. Bounce that pretty head off the ceiling and break your skinny neck, likely as not.
Gwen looked around and saw that the engineers were all at their various stations, their lines hooked up to rings heavily seated along the walls in duty stations. She watched as Journeyman began hooking up to the main panel and followed suit. He eyed her, grunted, and said,
"Just you stay out of my way."
"I wouldn't dream otherwise,"
Gwen assured him.
"All right, boys,"
Journeyman called. Etheric cannon howled again. The chief engineer clenched his jaw and said,
"Prepare to engage lift and trim crystals on my mark."
"Ready,"
called engineers in quick sequence from several stations.
"Wait,"
Gwen shouted.
"No, belay that."
She paused and frowned at Journeyman.
"That's the proper term, correct? Belay that?"
Journeyman scowled at her.
You are exactly in my way.
Gwen shook her head impatiently. If Predator suddenly rises up out of a slip, right here, under the enemy guns, what do you think will happen? How will they react? Journeyman stared at her for a second and then scowled furiously.
Damn it, damn it. Mist Shark doesn't have armor. She'll blow us to the surface for fear that we'll do the same to her if we can bring our guns to bear.
Yes, Gwen said. We can't take off yet. We have to sit here and not be a threat to them. Cannon howls. Another vast sound of thunder and a bone-deep groan that accompanied a sudden tilt of several degrees in the deck. Everyone in the engineering compartment looked around wildly, their eyes surrounded by white.
God in heaven,
one of the men breathed.
They're shooting the shipyard out from under us.
Journeyman grimaced.
We got no pilot aboard her. We got no crew to run out her web so she can maneuver.
Can we fight?
We got no gun crews. They're all off with the skipper. And we got no time for this.
The shipyard shook again, enormous groaning sounds running through the air and making the deck of Predator vibrate as she rocked back and forth, nearly throwing Gwen from her feet.
Oh, what can we do?
Go up and down, Journeyman shot back. Down'll be real easy.
Cannon howled again, and the roaring impact was even closer. The enemy, Gwen realized, was walking his shots toward Predator.
"Cause hot, Chief!"
called one of the engineers. Journeyman grunted and started manipulating the Haslett cage controls.
"Going to configure our shroud to cover our top half a bit thicker. Might give us an edge."
He turned his head.
"Trim and lift crews, stand by. We're going to start off with a little dive."
Every head in the room whipped around to stare at Journeyman.
"Dive protocol, you rot-riddled whoremongers,"
Journeyman bellowed.
"I take it a dive is dangerous?"
Gwen asked in a mild tone.
"With no pilot, more like suicidal,"
Journeyman said conversationally.
"No pilot to steer. We're likely to smash up against the side of the spire."
"What happens if we do that?"
"We go into a spin, all the way down, lift crystals or not. If we're lucky, the ship breaks up and we die on impact."
"Lucky?" Gwen asked.
"Better that than to wind up on the surface on foot with a smashed ship around us."
Gwen shuddered.
"I see what you..."
Etheric cannon howled again. Predator's core crystal flared with blinding light, and the ship lurched as if it had been struck with an enormous hammer. Thunder roared, a thing more felt than heard, and Gwen was nearly hurled from her feet despite the security straps. There was a horrible instant of complete stillness, and then the bottom of the world dropped out and Gwen felt her feet lift up off the deck. There were several sharp cries and screams, until Journeyman bellowed,
"Be quiet, you idiots!"
He was leaning back, his feet braced on the deck, his weight secured by the taut lifelines. His expression looked precisely as maladjusted as it did when he was not plunging helplessly to his death, Gwen noted.
"Lift!" Journeyman bellowed. "Give us 2%! We have to fall slower than that shipyard debris. Let it get clear of us before we stabilize."
2%, aye,
shouted another engineer. Gwen felt her heels sink back onto the floor again, and she grasped the ring on the panel with one hand, holding on until her knuckles were white.
Stand by,
Journeyman bellowed. Gwen heard him tapping his foot hard against the deck in steady rhythm, counting seconds, she realized. She shook her head at this display of cool and collected thinking, of single-minded focus amidst madness. And as she did, she noticed a single loose wire sprang out from the control panel. Gwen had no time for thought. Those wires conducted current from the Haslett cage to the ship's systems. If that wire was one of the ones running to the altitude crystal, or one of the ship's trim crystals, it would not receive power when the others did, and the results could be disastrous. Gwen unclipped one of her safety lines and lunged for the panel, all but throwing herself onto her back.
Three!
Journeyman bellowed. Gwen seized the loose wire.
Two!
Journeyman shouted. She spotted the open socket and rapidly slid the wire up into place, the starboard trim crystals. If she didn't get the system online, when the lift engineer sent power to the crystal array, the ship would begin to spin violently on its long axis and fly out of control with disastrous, probably fatal results. She fumbled with the wire, desperate with haste, knowing even as she did that she was too late.
One!
Journeyman called, as his hands flew over the power switches, opening channels of current from the core.
Engage the lift array!
Chapter 62. Spire Albion, Havel Landing, former shipyard. Blinding light from the explosion that had consumed Predator left a glowing blur in place of Grimm's normal vision. He shielded his eyes and blinked them rapidly, searching for his ship. The sight that greeted his eyes was almost unthinkable. The Mist Shark, her work done, had deployed her portside web and was heeling over neatly. In a moment she would spread her webs wide to catch the etheric currents and begin gathering speed, heading west by southwest, directly toward Spire Aurora. Grimm shook his head and lowered his eyes to the ground before him. The heavy timbers of the shipyard jutted out from the spire stone for perhaps 5 or 6 feet, and then ended abruptly in edges as rough as broken teeth. Beyond that was nothing but wind and mist and emptiness, where bustling industry had been only moments before. The landing shipyard was gone, and Predator was gone with it.
Gone.
Grimm tried to rise, but made it only as far as his knees. He felt his shoulders slump, and his skull suddenly seemed an unbearably heavy burden for his neck. The world started to spiral downward. He put one hand out to the spirestone wall to prevent the world from whirling him to the ground.
Predator was gone. Home was gone.
Journeyman and his engineers and his contractors had been on the ship. So had been Master Ferris. So had been Miss Gwendolyn. Everything had been aboard Predator. Voices spoke to him, but meant little. Hands helped him to his feet. He stood, though he saw no convincing reason to do so any more. A bright purple blur still marred his vision, the residue of the flash that had consumed his ship, his men, and his future.
"Away from the opening, sir,"
Kettle was saying, his voice rough.
"Mist Shark might still fire on us."
"No, she won't," Grimm heard himself saying in a thin, wooden voice.
"The shipyards, the gun emplacements and merchant vessels bearing supplies to Albion are all legitimate targets of war. Calliope's done all she came to do at this point. Now all that's left is to get away with it. She'll run."
Kettle's hand stayed firm on his arm.
"Then come away from the opening, sir, lest your feet slip and you fall."
Grimm felt something like anger at the careful phrasing in the pilot's voice. It was a distant thing, far away, but he felt it, like a heat moving up his spine. It had power enough to lift his head and let him stare at the pilot.
"Precisely what are you suggesting, mister?"
Kettle's steady grey eyes flickered with unease, and then flooded with a kind of profound relief.
"Oh, skipper, nothing, sir. Nothing at all."
Grimm regarded the man's expression and suddenly felt everything rushing back together behind his eyes. An explosion played backward that left his mind and will restored to some semblance of working order. There was pain, of course. There was horrible, horrible pain, a grief that he knew would at some point in the near future leave him a gibbering wreck. But for the time being, his men needed him. He might not have a ship anymore, but he still had a crew.
They were looking to him now, in this moment of despair and doubt.
So he straightened his coat, turned his back on the horribly empty sky behind him, and faced his men.
"Well, Mr. Kettle, we seem to have done all the damage we can. I'm not sure what my accounts will look like after paying death benefits to the families of the fallen, but you can be assured that I'll compensate you all as best as I am able, as well as putting a good word in one or two ears who might still be friendly to me in fleet. Experienced hands will certainly be needed in the weeks to come. I think none of you should lack for paying work."
"Skip?" Kettle asked, his tone uncertain.
"For now, of course, we will locate Dr. Bacon, Mr. Creedy, and our wounded, and see to it that they have the finest care available. I believe that is their group coming along the lane now, in fact. And naturally we will lend our assistance with the firefighting effort here in Habble Landing."
"Oh," said the etherealist's apprentice. "Oh, my goodness."
"Mr. Kettle," Grimm said, "please, delegate a crew of four to assist the good doctor in relocating the men to a hospice of some sort. The rest of us will proceed to the fire containment effort and join."
Bridget blinked owlishly, staring past him.
"Captain Grimm?"
she asked, her tone confused and curious.
"I'm fairly new to this sort of thing, but are you sure we oughtn't get on your ship?"
Grimm stared hard at Miss Tarquin, then at Kettle, studying the man's expression, then the face of the etherealist's apprentice, Miss Folly, and the countenances of his crew. Then he stiffened his spine into proper alignment, adjusted his hat, and turned very calmly. Rising up out of the mists, no more than 100 feet from the opening in the wall of Habble Landing, was the absolutely beautiful, entirely flawless, pristine, and very real shape of Predator. Grimm stared at the ship as she rose, steady and stately, until she hovered at the same level as the opening in the spire's wall. Her shape blurred for a moment, but he cleared his throat, blinked his eyes once, and that illusion passed. She was whole. Her shrouds had held.
"God in heaven," he whispered, "thank you for your grace."
There was a stir on the ship, and Mr. Journeyman appeared from below decks. He peered around and let out his breath in a low whistle when he saw the broken remains of the shipyards that still clung here and there to the outer wall of the spire.
"Mr. Journeyman!"
Grimm bellowed. The engineer straightened his back like a schoolchild caught in the middle of some mischief and threw a hasty salute toward the spire.
"Skipper! There you are!"
You, Grimm began. He ground his teeth and called,
"What have you done to my ship?"
Journeyman repeated his salute.
"Begging the captain's pardon, sir, but we got her all hooked up and took her for a test dive."
He coughed and said,
"It seemed like the thing to do, sir."
"Ah, a dive on lift and trim crystals alone with no pilot," Grimm said.
He took a breath and asked casually,
"How'd she do?"
Journeyman waggled a hand.
"Could use some fine tuning," he replied.
"Very good,"
Grimm said, nodding, and folded his hands behind his back. "Should you ever do such a reckless and muzzle-headed thing with my ship again, there'll be hell to pay, Mr. Journeyman. Am I clear?" Journeyman's face went a bit pale. He braced to attention and snapped off a salute.
"Yes, sir!"
"Predator is not your personal play toy, placed there by God in heaven for your amusement."
"No, sir!"
"Do you hear me, Journeyman?"
"I do, sir!"
"Good. Now get my ship in close enough to throw us some lines so that we can belay you and get the planks down. Move, Journeyman."
"Yes, sir!"
Journeyman said, snapping off a last salute, and dashed back below decks, roaring out orders. Grimm spun on the rest of the crew, to find them grinning at his back.
"Miss Folly," Grimm asked, ignoring them for a moment, "can you confirm the location of Master Ferris's collection?"
The oddly dressed young woman's eyes slipped out of focus for a moment, and then she frowned indignantly, muttering to her crystal.
"It is moving away from the spire rather rapidly. That horrible puppet woman has them on that ship."
"Can you follow her, miss?"
Folly frowned.
"If the master's collection doesn't get too far away from us, I believe I could follow them."
Grimm nodded once, rounded on his men, and raised his voice to an authoritative roar.
"What are you pack of apes gawking at?" Grimm snapped at them. "We have men suffering from silkweaver poison. Dr. Bagan cannot help them, but the etherealist can. To do so, he needs his gear, currently sailing away from us on the Mist Shark, along with the Aurora Marines who have caused so much harm to our fellow Albions."
A round of growls, led by Kettle's deep-chested snarl, rose up among the men.
"I mean to take Predator after Mist Shark, run her down, hammer her until she surrenders, and get Master Ferris's equipment so that he can save our shipmates. Given the losses we've taken, we'll be running short on hands. But make no mistake, we will speak with our cannon nonetheless. Any man who wishes to stay behind will not be censured."
Kettle glanced around at the crew, taking the measure of their stances and expressions, and nodded once.
"We're all in, Captain."
"Then make ready to belay the ship and secure our loading ramp into position as soon as Journeyman warps her in."
"Aye, Skipper,"
Journeyman said.
"You two with me, and the rest of you into two lines on either side of the hallway."
Grimm let the pilot take charge of the situation and turned to Miss Folly and her companion.
"Miss Tarquin, how are you feeling?"
The tall young woman blinked her eyes closed and open, and then managed a slight nod. She still leaned slightly against the etherealist's apprentice for support, but now cradled Master Rowl in both arms. The cat was awake, though distant, his body limp, his eyes focused on nothing.
"Better, Captain."
"You've done enough," Grimm said. "I'll be sending the most grievously wounded men to the care of a hospice. You will go with them."
Miss Targwin pondered his words for a moment before she shook her head and said,
"No, thank you, Captain. I will remain with Sir Benedict."
"I am the captain of that vessel," Grimm said gently. "We will be going into battle, and you have no training or experience that would make you useful to our cause. The decision is not yours to make."
The young woman nodded and said, "I am certain you can have me beaten until I'm not capable of boarding the ship, sir."
Then she looked up and met his eyes. Her gaze was steady, penetrating and eerily feline.
"Is that what you mean to do?"
Grimm felt his mouth twitch at the corner.
"No, Miss Targwin, it certainly is not. But if you are to insist on coming along, I will have your word that you will accept my orders as the voice of God in heaven himself once you are aboard."
"Very well,"
she said.
Grimm nodded to her.
"What you did, back at the temple, that was quite remarkable."
He felt a smile touch his eyes. "Sir Benedict is a fortunate man."
"He would have done the same for me, sir,"
Miss Targwin assured him.
"Of that I have no doubt."
Behind him, Journeyman had gotten Predator close enough to toss a pair of lines to Kettle and the crew. The men began taking them up and working together to carefully pull the ship into position at the opening in the outer wall of the spire. It would take only a few moments to get the loading ramp into position. Mr. Creedy came shuffling up to Grimm and saluted wearily. The strain on his face from carrying one of the wounded was evident.
"Captain,"
he panted,
"what did I miss?"
"Next payday, schedule a bonus month's pay to Mr. Journeyman and his engineering team," Grimm replied.
Creedy blinked. Then he glanced past Grimm to the shadow of Predator, hovering where the Hubble Landing shipyard had been only moments before, and his jaw dropped open.
"God in heaven,"
he breathed.
"It was the Mist Shark," Grimm said simply. "The Aurorans and that Cavendish woman are aboard her. We're going to run her down and take her."
"We're short on crew," Creedy said. "We'll be light on guns."
"Yes," Grimm said.
"Mist Shark is larger and more heavily armed than Predator."
"Yes."
"Very good, Captain," Creedy said. "What are my orders?"
"Get the wounded aboard and secured, then report to me on the bridge."
Creedy nodded sharply and turned to go. He paused. "Captain, if Mist Shark is already away, how are we to catch her? She's the fastest thing in the sky." Grimm felt his mouth stretch into a wolfish smile.
Chapter 63 AMS Predator. Folly stood on the deck of Predator and felt the ship rouse herself to life. It was, she thought, really rather disturbing. The wooden deck felt quite solid and did not move at all, and yet she could feel it shiver and flex slightly, like some enormous beast waking after a sleep and slowly stretching its limbs. Men rushed about and began climbing her masts, plying lines and preparing to unspool the great reels of vibrating, glowing ether silk, as bright to Folly's eyes as coiled lines of living light. There was a deep shudder below the decks, and Folly had to catch her breath in sudden shock, as something like the beat of a great living heart thrummed through the air. The ship quivered and creaked and then began to rise. There was a sense of focused attention, as if an enormous pair of eyes had begun to look around, and Folly felt them pass over her, as if she were a mouse that had been glanced at by a distant cat. She felt as if her heart were going to stop. There was, she felt, a sense of gentle amusement that thrummed through the air. And then, quite clearly, a voice said, "Peace, child. I have no quarrel with you today, and much more interesting prey to consider."
"Oh," Folly said, "oh, my, pray, do not let me distract you."
A passing crewman eyed Folly with a decidedly skeptical air.
"You do not," said the great voice. "Come this way, child. Pray, excuse me. I have work to do."
Just then the grim captain called out and flicked his wrist in an authoritative gesture, and with that Predator began to soar upward. Folly stood transfixed in a sudden rush of fierce, rising joy as the ship rose up through the mists and the wind began to rush around them. Her feet drew her forward, following the current of attention and focus toward a tower that stood at the front of the ship. She climbed it, slowly and carefully, to find herself standing a few feet behind the grim captain and the young captain and the pilot at the controls of the ship.
"Good God in heaven, skipper!" the pilot called over the wind. "Can you feel her?"
"Aye," the grim captain called back. "Moving rather well, isn't she?"
"Well?"
the pilot roared, laughing. He twitched the controls slightly and the ship banked left, then right, graceful and light.
"God in heaven! Wait until we fight her!"
The sense of joy Folly had felt became suffused with an equally ferocious pride, and a sudden pulse of love so palpable that she felt tears filling her eyes.
"Steady as she goes, Mr. Kettle," the grim captain said, his voice stern.
His eyes, though, were smiling as he glanced around, and looked brighter than she had ever seen them, more alive.
"Oh," Folly breathed, "it's like seeing a caged bird suddenly fly. You never really saw it until then."
His eyes switched to her.
"What was that, Miss Folly?"
Folly touched her crystal and told it.
"Very revealing."
The grim captain arched an eyebrow at her.
"Very good. I was just about to send for you."
The grim captain turned to the young captain.
"Mr. Creedy, fetch the young lady a harness, if you would, and help her into it. I doubt we'll need it soon, but best we get her settled."
"Aye, sir," said the young captain. He nodded politely to Folly and went down the steep stairs to the bridge by bracing his feet and hands on the rails and sliding neatly down them.
"Miss," the grim captain said, holding out a hand, gesturing for her to join him.
Folly stepped up to the space beside the captain, at the front rail of the ship, and nearly lost her breath. From here she could see the great reels of ether silk spreading like enormous wings for hundreds of feet around the ship, pulled forward by currents of etheric energy, suffused and illuminated with it, blazing through the mist like some vast cobweb of living lightning. A faint sphere of flickering light surrounded the ship at a distance of 30 or 40 yards, a screen of energy that sparkled against the individual droplets of mist as the ship raced forward through them. Air and light filled her vision. The rest of the ship's crude matter vanished here at the very prow, and only the vast, spreading space of the sky and its flow of energy, modestly veiled in mist, opened up around them.
"It's a pleasant view," said the grim captain, in a voice that told Folly that the man made a habit of taking understatement to new heights. "I never get tired of it. Do you, Kettle?"
The pilot, who stood on a small platform just behind the grim captain, let out a belly laugh as his only answer. The grim captain smiled, an expression in his eyes that was an exact reflection of the fierce, joyous serenity of purpose flowing through the ship around Folly. He put his hands on the rail and leaned forward into the wind, his eyes narrowed with pleasure.
"Oh," she breathed, "I see it now. Predator is you, and you are she."
He blinked and turned to give her a curious look.
"Were you addressing me, Miss Folly?"
"Yes, Captain,"
Folly said.
"I can, here. You are..."
She waved a hand.
"Appropriate."
The great voice of the ship said,
"Precisely, child. Those are my feelings on the matter, precisely."
I see," the grim captain said. "Then I hope you will not find it too inconvenient if I ask for a bit of guidance. I need to know where Mist Shark is to catch her."
"Oh, I couldn't possibly tell you that,"
Folly said, shifting her feet uncertainly.
"I can only tell you where the Master's collection is."
The grim captain's mouth spread in a rather politely predatory smile.
"That will do, Miss Folly. That will do nicely."
Folly nodded and turned her focus inward. She could see where the Master's collection was, if only she gave the matter some consideration. She focused her thoughts on it, on the energy of the crystals she'd placed with the collection and marked with the proper patterns, and there it was, like a glowing star on the horizon. She could see the star blazing clearly, despite the mist, and could have seen it if a wooden wall or 20 yards of spire-stone were blocking her view. By focusing on the star, she could even draw it closer, and view the space around it, an enclosed wooden space, a cabin aboard a ship with a second great beating heart, much like Predator's, but thrumming with a labored note.
"There,"
she said, pointing her finger left and at an angle upward.
"She's running for the blue," said the grim captain with a certain note of satisfaction. "She'll want to stay hidden at the edge of the mist until she can get outside of Albion's defensive carousel, I expect. 2 points to port, and let's match her ascent, Mr. Kettle."
2 points to port and match her ascent, aye,"
said the pilot, his hands steady on the controls. "You called that one pretty close."
"I know her skipper," the grim captain said calmly.
"Then you know she'll have some kind of trick at hand," the pilot growled.
"This time, Mr. Kettle, I struck first."
"Sir?"
The captain's voice grew a few shades more satisfied.
"I sent Mr. Stern aboard Mist Shark a while ago. He painted the inside of their Haslett cage with what was left of that stew I almost cooked in the galley the other night. The pilot made a choking sound. Then his belly laugh emerged again. The grim captain did not bend so far as to laugh, but the smile that suddenly suffused his features was beatific.
"I'm sorry, Captain,"
Folly said.
"I don't understand."
"Grease and other organic material, Miss Folly," he told her. "The Haslett cage conducts power from the ship's core in the form of electricity. The closer you move the cage, the more current flows into it, and the hotter it gets."
Folly frowned.
"Then, I beg your pardon, but wouldn't that burn the soup?"
"Burn it black,"
the pilot said, an unrepentant leer in his tone.
"Burn it to baked jelly and soot."
"That would not be very good for the Haslett cage, one assumes,"
Folly asked. "Precisely," the grim captain said.
"Play merry hell with their power distribution," the pilot said. "Put a huge strain on their system. Reduce the power being conducted to Mist Shark's web by maybe 10%. It's the same trick that bi-"
The grim captain gave the pilot a sharp look and flicked his eyes toward Folly. The pilot coughed.
"That big bunch of cheaters pulled on us in the Olympian air trials a couple years back," he said. "It's the only reason they beat us."
The grim captain said nothing and kept smiling, but there was a fierce glint pulsing in his eyes, and Folly could feel the ship's heart beating in time with it.
"It'll take some time," the pilot continued, "but once it sets in, we'll overhaul Mist Shark quick enough, and have control of the engagement to boot."
"But until we do," the grim captain said, "we'll need you to stay here, Miss Folly, to help us follow them in this mist."
"I will," Folly said thoughtfully. "But I should be near the master."
She frowned and closed her eyes for a moment. She ordered her thoughts, and then asked tentatively,
"Can you hear me like this?"
"Of course," said the voice of the ship. Folly found the pattern of the crystals in the master's collection, found the glowing red star of retreating energy.
"Do you see this?"
"I do. Why are you showing it to me, child?"
"It is aboard the ship we hunt," Folly said. "Can you show it to the others?"
"Can they not see it as you do?"
"I do not think so," Folly told the ship.
"Poor things,"
the ship said, the voice suffused with fondness.
"They mean well."
Folly opened her eyes to see the point where the red star blazed suddenly echoed with a halo of red light sparkling off the sphere of defensive energy that surrounded the ship.
"God in heaven!"
the pilot breathed. The ship quivered in response to the jerk of his hands on the controls, then steadied again.
"Skip!"
The grim captain peered ahead at the ghostly scarlet star of light hovering in the mist.
"Miss Folly, is this your doing?"
"Oh, yes. Well, no, not precisely,"
Folly said.
"I asked Predator to show you where the master's collection is."
There was a long silence on the bridge, broken when the pilot said in a flat voice,
"What?"
"You must forgive them," the ship's voice said to Folly. "The dear things are blind and almost deaf. Except for my captain, of course. He hears me better than all but a few, like yourself."
"I'm sure they try very hard,"
Folly said aloud. Then she bobbed a curtsy to the grim captain.
"Predator can guide you now that she knows what to look for, sir. May I go to the master?"
The stairs and guide rail rattled as the young captain began to climb them. The grim captain turned to regard her, and nodded rather deeply.
"Aye, miss. As soon as Mr. Creedy has shown you the harness and how to use it to stay safe. We'll be manoeuvring before long, and I don't want you to be hurt."
"Yes, Captain,"
Folly said.
The grim captain flashed her a sudden grin and turned to face front again, hands sliding thoughtfully back and forth along the railing.
Mr. Kettle.
Aye, skipper.
Follow that star.
Chapter 64. AMS Predator. Bridget abruptly realized that she was sitting on a stool in a crowded room with a low ceiling. There was a plain pewter cup in her hands, half filled with water. A thick blanket had been laid across her shoulders. She was shivering. She was thirsty. Her head hurt. Her leg hurt. Her hands ached horribly. She lifted the cup and stared for a moment at the swelling and bruises on her hands, at the torn flesh on her fingers and knuckles. Then she shivered, finished the water, and took in her surroundings carefully. The walls and floor and furniture were all made of wood, so she must be on an airship. There were a number of wounded men in the room on pallets. Several of the men had faces she recognized from the desperate battle in the ventilation tunnels, so it stood to reason that she was back aboard Predator. Bridget frowned, trying to put together her memories of the period between now and that battle. She remembered a fire and a terrible weight on her shoulders, a sharp blow to her head from a falling stone, and a man in an Auroran uniform, a man she had killed with her battered hands. She remembered that perfectly. Bridget contemplated that in silence for a moment. She decided that she neither liked nor regretted the act, and that it had been absolutely awful. If she had not done it, neither she nor Benedict would have... Bridget shot to her feet abruptly. Benedict! Where was Benedict? The wooden room swayed, and she felt herself sink back into the chair before she fell down. She had to grip the seat of the stool beneath her to keep from falling off.
"Easy, easy," said a young woman's voice from next to her.
A hand on her shoulder steadied her.
"You look as though you've had quite enough adventure for the time being."
Bridget looked up at the speaker and blinked twice.
"Gwen?"
Gwendolyn Lancaster looked exceptionally odd. In the first place, she was wearing men's clothing that was much, much too large for her. The clothes were covered with grease and soot, as was perhaps two-thirds of her face. Her right hand was so thickly wrapped in bandages that it could not be seen as anything but a lump, and her hair, beneath another stained bandage, resembled the spreading wings of an airship's charged ether silk web, standing out from her head in a small cloud.
"You look awful," Bridget said.
"You're one to talk," Gwen said. She sighed, leaned back against the wall, and slowly slid down it until she was sitting beside Bridget.
"What happened?"
Gwen waved her bandaged hand.
"I learned that one ought to be extremely cautious when connecting live wires during free fall. Are you well?"
Gwen grimaced as she looked around the room.
"More so than some, it would seem."
Her eyes came back to Bridget.
"And you?" "I feel ill, and my leg hurts."
Gwen nodded toward the center of the room, where a pair of aeronauts were carefully lifting a wounded man down from an examination table and over to a pallet. Dr. Bagan, looking worn, tired and bloody, nodded to another pair of aeronauts, who lifted the wiry young man named Stern onto the table.
"Dr. Bagan doesn't think your injuries are life-threatening. I'm afraid you'll have to wait the longest to be seen." "Sitting quietly sounds quite agreeable at the moment," Bridget said. "Where is Benedict?"
Gwen's face clouded.
"On a pallet on the other side of the table. He's unconscious."
Unconscious. Unconscious meant alive. He was still alive. Bridget slowly unclenched her hands.
"What is his condition?"
The smaller girl pressed her lips together into a line, and her expression became a careful mask.
"Less than ideal. Like several of the crew, he has been poisoned by silk weaver venom." "Then he's... She couldn't bring herself to say dying. In serious condition.
He's dying, Gwen said.
Bridget felt her stomach clench. Gwen continued in a level voice.
They all are.
Apparently Master Ferris can help them.